What one thing do you wish you'd have known 10 years ago?
10 years ago, Eddie, that's like a hard question because I got to think, okay, how old am I now? What was 10 years ago? So I moved to the UK like 11 years ago. And so I guess what I wish I knew at that point was that it's easier to move abroad than I thought it would be, especially doing what we do in marketing. And so I'd wish I'd done that sooner, but I didn't do it sooner because my goal was like, pay off my student debt first, which isn't very much compared to the Americans, but pay off my student debt and then move abroad so that I don't have the weight of student debt on my ability to succeed in a foreign country that I've never been to. So that's the thing I wish I knew sooner.
Okay. No, I like that. I like that.
Hey, up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I am the host of the show and the Strategy Director at Eximo Marketing. I'm here today to welcome you and to introduce you to today's guest. It's Dwayne Brown from an agency called Take Some Risks. But we're not here to talk about agency stuff so much. I try and avoid the agency podcast thing because there's a lot of people do that better than I do anyway. I'm here really to talk about Dwayne's move from doing delivery into doing strategy. I think it's really interesting because it's something that a lot of agency owners try and move into and try and get into at some point in their journey. They often start in digital agencies, at least they're subject matter experts doing PPC, SEO, social media, something like that. And then over time, start to move from doing for you to thinking for you and going into from delivery into strategy. What's interesting when I talk to Dwayne as well is that he wants to move kind of beyond marketing strategy into business strategy as well. So we talk about kind of the different layers of that and how that all works and knits together. I really enjoyed this conversation with Dwayne. I love how he thinks about things. I love how he tackles problems. And I hope you enjoy it too. Any comments, any thoughts, please let me know. And as always, I know every podcaster says it, but it really does make a massive difference. If you just take your phone out of your pocket or your bag or wherever it is at the minute and go to whatever podcast platform you're listening on and just leave a little rating, ideally 5-star rating, or share the episode with your friends. It really does make a difference to the numbers and to, you know, the people behind the podcast. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to shut up now and let's bring Dwayne in for the interview. Thanks very much.
When you got to the UK, was that your first? Had you visited before as like a tourist, or was this your first time in this great country? And you were like, this is not like the movies. Is that what it was like?
No, it was actually my second time in the UK. A year earlier, I'd came to visit a friend who was at like London School of Economics for a year, and I made him a promise that I would come visit him before his year was up. And so I had to come visit in September a year earlier, otherwise I wouldn't keep my promise. And I'm a man who keeps my promise. But I'll be honest, I didn't like London when I came to visit it. I found it was like too big, I guess, and too smelly. It just wasn't what I expected. I liked Manchester a lot more, but I moved to London because more jobs are in London. I thought it'd be easier to just find a job for advertising.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hate myself a little bit when I travel to countries and only go to the capital city, because I think if people come to the UK and they do London, and I love London, I love it dearly. I've never lived there, but I love going to visit it. I think it's a great city. But if you come to England and only go to London, you're missing out on so much. There's so many great cities. I'm a northerner, so Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle, Leeds. Maybe not Bradford where I'm from, but you know, there's so many great cities, and people come and they do London, Edinburgh, and go home, maybe Dublin, and then leave. I mean, but I do wish people would sort of get out of the capital cities more. So it's interesting that you went to Manchester and went, okay, I like this place, this is cool, and that was sort of your vibe when you got there.
Yeah, it was. I think at the time it was cheaper for me to fly to Manchester, I think is why I picked it. And then I didn't realize it was actually Pride weekend that weekend that I booked to fly in. So as a gay, it was the best weekend in the world because all the gays were in the city and there was lots of good entertainment and there was lots to do. So I really liked Manchester. And then someone told me it was easy to take a train from Manchester to London, which, I mean, it is easy, but it doesn't run as often as they made it seem. Because they also diverted my flight to like some other city. So I had to go from that city to Manchester. And then we were there for the weekend. And then we went to London. And then I also did like Berlin and like Milan on this like 2-week trip I had. So I liked it. But yeah, I agree. People should, you know, leave major cities if they go somewhere and check out like the second biggest city. Or if you're in the Mediterranean, check out the coast and stuff like that. Because the coast of the Mediterranean are always really beautiful, really good food. If you're into like seafood, fish, stuff like that.
Well, I've spent probably too long on the last few podcasts talking about trains in Britain. So rather than talking about your painful experience with the British trains, Let's just, if you're all right, let's just talk about Pride in Manchester for a minute, because Manchester is renowned for its sort of huge and welcoming gay scene, which probably outside, I don't know for certain, I've never been around and counted, but I think outside of London is probably the biggest in the country, I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. And it's a big change, I think, from sort of 30, 40 years ago. And it has a real sort of energy about the city now. And is that what you found when you landed there at Pride weekend? And it was just like, what? Where have I come?
Yeah, I guess because before that, I'd only really been to Pride in Canada in a few places. And so, like, I remember vividly, like, we landed, I was with my friend who's coming with me. And, like, they had, like, this in Manchester, like, they had, you know, the village cornered off, right? Because you had mm-hmm. to pay, like, £30 for, like, the wristband, because the wristband helped went towards the charity that runs Pride and stuff like that, which was, like, very different than how we do it in Canada. In Canada, there is no cornered off section unless it's a beer garden. And even then, you don't really pay to get in. You just pay for the beer when you're in the garden. So it was very different mm-hmm. to pay for, like, a wristband, but I get where the money was going, so it was fine. But I remember we were walking, like, along the river, and I guess this young person was already way drunk. And it was, well, for me, it's early. It's 10 o'clock. You don't get drunk at 10 o'clock. But they were drunk, and they were down to their, like underwear, and they had their pants off, and they were, like, in the river, and cops were trying to get them out the river. And I'm like, wow, that's not something you see at Pride every day. But it was a good weekend, so it was good shows. You know, I met some cute boys. Everyone was really friendly when they find out you have an accent. And so I had a really, really good time. It was unexpected because, again, I didn't plan to go to Manchester that weekend because it was Pride. It just happened to be Pride when I had my birthday because it was like a cheap weekend, which I didn't really realize.
Yeah.
But it was a really good experience. I mean, Pride, I think in general around the world, has gotten a lot better in a lot of places. Obviously, some places in Africa and some places sort of in, like, you know, deep Eastern Europe and obviously Russia and stuff like that are still trying to, like, be more accepted in tolerance, which is unfortunate, but in other places are getting better. A lot more places have legalized more things in Asia, which, you know, that's taken a long time to get there, but they've become a lot better as a continent. So it's one of those time things, but things are a lot better today than they were, you know, 40 years ago before I was even born.
Yeah, perfect. No, and look, welcome to Britain, I suppose, is the message for London in Manchester Pride. And we're like, okay, this is different. So, yeah, what an introduction to the country. well, listen, let's also talk. Maybe it's less interesting. I don't know. People are screaming. Just keep talking about Pride. I don't know. But let's talk about marketing a little bit more. That's why you're here. That's how we know each other. So, tell us a little bit about what you do in the marketing world and where you do it. You've mentioned you've got an accent and all that sort of stuff. So tell us a little bit of background about your company and what it is and what you do.
Yeah, I mean, we've changed a lot over the last 7 years. Like, when I left my job originally and just to, like, go work for myself, you know, when you go work for yourself for the first year, you probably take work from anyone as long as it's in your wheelhouse of what you do. So, like, you know, I run paid advertising. So we run ads on, you know, Meta and TikTok and Google and Microsoft for clients. And, you know, back in, you know, 2017, yeah, we just would take it for anyone. And that was good. And then I realized at the end of 2018, you know, there are certain sort of industries or sectors I don't want to work on. And so we sort of niche down to, like, you know, e-commerce brands, SaaS brands, and a bit of tech. And that worked out really well. And then the pandemic hit. And pretty much these days, you know, 99% of our business is sort of e-commerce, and it's split between, like, B2C, you know, D2C, B2C e-commerce. Then we have a number of, like, B2B e-commerce brands, which are kind of interesting because I think B2B e-commerce often gets neglected because it's not as, like, sexy as, mm-hmm. like, you work for, like, Away or one of those big brands that raise lots of money. But B2B often have been around longer. They have tons of money. They have tons of need. There's not as much competition of people who want to service B2B e-commerce brands. There's lots of, like, B2B SaaS and tech is very well covered in the agency space, but, like, B2B e-com, I don't know of any agency who just does B2B e-com. It probably exists maybe, but I don't know it. And so we focus on mostly e-commerce with a bit of SaaS. You know, our job is to help clients run better campaigns on Google, Microsoft, Amazon, you know, Meta, TikTok, really at the end of the day. And that's what we're good at. That's why clients come to us. But, like, what I want to do is I basically want to become, like, a Deloitte in the sense that people come to us for the strategy and then we just happen to also do the execution, right? Mm-hmm. Which right now people come to us for the, you know, execution and we just happen to do strategy. And I want to flip it so that we can basically charge more money. That's my dream. I don't know how I'm going to make that flip happen because I've been saying the same thing for the last 3 years, but that's the goal. I'm trying to figure out how to make that flip happen. Because I realized, you know, as Google and Meta and all the platforms introduce more technology and artificial intelligence and yada, 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 there's still a need for what we do, but it's less like pushing buttons and more, you know, guiding the machines in the right way. And I enjoy strategy a lot more. You know, before we recorded this, we were talking about like clients getting rid of certain products and adding certain products. And that I enjoy that as a conversation. That's more strategic of how to run a better business versus like, you know, change my bid strategy today or pause this ad, which is important because you want to make sure money goes in the right place, but it doesn't get you paid as well.
Is any of that driven by the rise of AI and automation in paid advertising across the web? Now, again, we'll get into this maybe in a little bit more in depth. I have issues and concerns and challenges, but I don't think AI is ever going to completely replace the person. But if you go back 10, 15 years, bid strategies, everything was manually done, wasn't it? And now almost everything's sort of automated with a little bit of human oversight. Is that partly why you want to get into the strategy, or have you been sort of on that road anyway for a little while?
Yeah, we've been on the road for a while. You know, the first client we charged a strategy fee to was like in Feb 2018. And since then, we've always charged a client a strategy fee. So that's like our base fee for the month. And then we charge them a percent of ad spend based on what we manage. So we've always done it. And clients get it. It's like, yeah, well, you want to think about what you're going to do and make sure the strategy makes sense for when we're at a million versus when we're at 5 million or 10 million. That's great. Or it makes sense when we're only online and now we're online and we've got retail stores and we're on Amazon. You want to make sure, again, your strategy makes sense as you go. So that makes sense. I think the challenge is sometimes brands and people be like, oh, I just want to come up with a strategy. I just want you to execute. And I'm like, why? Not a puppet. You're not just going to tell me what to do. Because if you could do what I could do, you would have done it and not hired me. So I think it's getting clients to realize like strategy is really important. And I think there's like different kinds of strategy, right? You've got like advertising strategy, you've got marketing strategy, and then you've got business strategy. And lots of people will sell advertising strategy, but I want to sell business strategy. So let's connect what we do in marketing with what you do in the business and help you run a better business. Because if you run a better business, ideally you'd be a long time. You know, we've had clients pass in the 4 and 5 year mark this year, and we're 7 years in business. So clearly we're doing something right. But how do we get more clients to realize that you could hire 4 people and they all have 10 years experience, but just because you have 10 years experience doesn't mean you've actually learned anything over those 10 years. You know, what knowledge have you acquired in that 10 years that can be applied to that client? But clients don't view it that way. They just think everyone's the same if they all have 10 years experience, when really you want to understand their knowledge and that experience so that you can apply it to your business. Otherwise, it could be someone who's just worked on a lot of like dentist clients, for example, and has no idea how to run e-com. Well, you're going to be up a creek without a paddle because that person doesn't know what they're going to do.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's interesting, this sort of demarcation between business strategy, marketing strategy. I often explain it as the sort of three layers. You often need that business strategy to understand that sort of 3-5 year direction you're taking it in. I break marketing strategy down into sort of 1 year increments to help you move towards it, because you should have to renew it every year. And then beneath that, like say advertising strategy, I call them sort of channel strategies, because you might have a influencer marketing or social media strategy, and they kind of all work together. But the number of businesses who don't have a formal business strategy is frightening and terrifying, in fact. But it happens, doesn't it? And there's sometimes businesses are doing really, really well, and you're like, oh, so what's your strategy? And you're like, I don't know. We're just kind of doing it, and sales are coming in and making decisions on an ad hoc basis on the best, you know, what's the best idea here? So is that the sort of thing you see as well? And you're thinking, hold on, we can solve this problem for clients.
Yes. I would say clients you described, I call them our creative clients. They're people who didn't really run a business or want to run a business. They just had an idea for something of a product that scratched their own itch or a product they saw in the market, and they went and they kind of just figured out as they go. And there's nothing wrong with that. Figuring out as you go could be a good thing if you can make all the right decisions, but having some sort of plan is usually a good idea. And that's the kind of thing we try to help clients, is try to like formalize and operationalize things, is what we call it, so that there's, you know, systems and processes for things. Because if you're a creative person, you probably don't have a lot of systems. You kind of just fly by the seat of your pants. And people often think that like systems and processes are bad. It's what, you know, big corporations do, and so it must be a bad thing. But having processes to do things isn't a bad thing in and of itself, as long as you're doing the system processes in the right area of the business. Not everything needs a process, but most things that you're going to repeat daily, weekly, should have some sort of process so that you can hand off that job to somebody else when you hire them. That means writing out like, how do we do this job? And here are the steps, and here's the things you need to do, including step number 11, which is proofread all your work to make sure you did the work the right the first time, so you can get it done. And so, yeah, we help clients try to operationalize things strategically. And some clients, it means getting rid of apps, because sometimes clients will sign up for an app or buy a product, spend $30,000 for the year, but never use it. And so like, well, why do we get rid of this, this, and this and consolidate it with this app? Or why do we do this over here? Because it's cheaper. You know, one client spent $400 a month on a customer review app. And we're like, why would you spend $400 on a review app? It's like $100 a month for all the competitors. But they wanted to try to be like a bigger business than they were. And I'm like, well, you're a millionaire and they're 10. You don't need what they have. You need like something down here.
Yep.
So again, clients have realized to maybe get back to earth is kind of important, because if you spend the money you don't have, you're going to put yourself in a business you don't have in a year, because you're not going to have any money. And so getting clients to realize, let's spend money on where it matters and not spend money just to like try to be a bigger business than we are. Because being a $1 million business is still a really important business, because not everyone can get to $1 million. It's really hard.
Yeah, it's this is almost one of the scary things. I don't know about scary, but it's one of the interesting things I find when you talk to Americans. And you're obviously just over the border from America, but you know, in the UK, if you are doing, say, I don't know, 50 million in revenue, right? If you're doing 50 million in revenue, you're probably, I'm going to guess, in like the top 3%, 5% of companies in the country, maybe even less than that, right? But you're in a very small percentage. But when you talk to Americans, they're like, oh yeah, you know, I'm working with this, you know, tiny dental group. They're just in, and they give you a place, a name of a place that you've never heard of in a state that you didn't even think existed, right? And you're like, okay, never heard of this place. And go, yeah, so I'm working with this tiny company there. They're doing $150 million in revenue. And you're like, how? What? How do you get that big? Well, that's just the states, isn't it? And it's just enormous. And every state is probably about the size of Canada, isn't it, in terms of people?
California is the size of Canada. So it's about 41 million people. All the other states are usually in the 10 to, you know, $20 million range in terms of people. Especially like New York State and Illinois, Florida and Texas being the, you know, next biggest states population-wise. But yeah, okay. I mean, you can, depending on what you sell, you could do, you know, really big business just in California. You know, we've got a, you know, four or five clients based, you know, somewhere around either San Fran or LA. And one client just told us the other day they're going to open a new store in Berkeley, which is just outside of San Fran, for those who don't know. And so, you know, you can do big business just in California and do really well. But yeah, it is, you know, $100 million, you know, might be considered small in America. But when you think about the UK is what, 60, 67 million people?
Yeah,
you know, America's 350, 400 million people, you know. The UK is, you know, five times as small as America. So it's easy for them to like do that sense of business because they do have the scale, right? Yeah. Whereas if you look at like, you know, Europe is the size of America, right? So if you're across Europe and you're not doing the same thing as they would do in America, well, then either the demand isn't there in Europe or you're doing something wrong.
Yeah. And there's a lot of companies doing things wrong, which is why we have a job. Well, certainly why I have a job anyway, because a lot of companies making a mess of a lot of things. I think I said to a client just the other day, I was like, every organization I work with is a mess. It's just some of them function better than others. That's all it is. I don't think, have you ever worked with an organization you were like, wow, they've got their shit together everywhere?
No, not in marketing. Yeah. Marketing's always a mess. It's people either don't know what they're doing, they didn't want to put any processes because they're too busy, or they don't think processes are going to make sense, or people got hired and they've just been in a job for 20 years and no one's going to fire them because they've been there for 20 years, but they also don't know what they're doing. So at least in marketing, it's always a mess. Yeah, it's why we have a job. It's why I'm grateful when people make mistakes. I'm like, I can come in and look like a genius and just do the basic stuff that like I know is the basics, but the client thinks that I'm a genius because I switch things around. I'm like, I'm not a genius. I just did like the basics. And sometimes... you know, maybe that is considered a genius because you did the basics and you did it right. Like getting the fundamentals right is almost a professional way to run things. But clients don't realize the difference between a professional and a non-professional. Because again, they think everyone with a 10 years experience is the same, when in reality, they're not.
I find 80% of what I do is surfacing things that have already been said by people in the organization. Giving them credit for it. I'm not just pinching other people's ideas and presenting it back to the senior team. So crediting it. But the two words I try and talk about all the time in most client engagements are focus and momentum. And it's not about, people think, oh, this is a marketing strategy. You're going to throw all these creative ideas at us. And the bulk of the time, most of the things I do is like, here's a list of five things you need to stop doing right now. which will give you the focus to focus on the things you were doing. There's nothing new. We're just going to kill all this stuff that's not contributing. Focus on this thing that is, and then we're going to break it down into small steps to create momentum. And that's it. And they're like, yeah, but where's the creative ideas? I'm like, do you see the spreadsheet that shows how much money this will make if you do this thing right? Yes. Well, let's do the creative daft big ideas next. Well, let's get focus and momentum first. And yeah, that's the bulk of the job is trying to create those two things, because most organizations are a bit of a mess in one way or another, including my own. You know, I'm no different to anyone else. My organization's a mess as well. Sorry, go on. There wasn't a question but have you got anything to say on that?
I was going to say, it's good you can admit it. Organization is not a mess. The team will tell you I'm OCD on organization processes. We got everything written out in a Notion, even things people think we wouldn't have written out. If we do it daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, there's a process for it. It's written out so that, you know, if I get sick, you can easily take over my job and do it. But then it's also easy because, you know, we have someone who's on the West Coast of Vancouver. You know, mm-hmm. we've had people based in South America, based in Africa. We've got people, you know, on the team right now based in Europe. And so we're working, you know, times that overlap, but we also work in times where we're not all online at the same time. If somebody wants to work a weekend because their kid is sick during the week or whatever. And so having our processes means that people don't have to ask me questions of things of like, how do I do this? Or what's the situation for that? Or what's the process for getting access to an account? It's all written there. So work hard not to be messy. I'm the organization people need and want. They just have to realize that sometimes I'm going to drag you kicking and screaming to get this done, whether you like it or not. Because if you want to be successful and really be successful, you're going to have to put some processes in place and get some focus. Because yeah, people try to do too much. I often say this a lot with advertising. People, you know, let's say they've been doing a lot of email and SEO for a long time, or PR and influencer. You know, they want to do paid ads. What they often do is they want to be everywhere at once. So I want to be on Google and Microsoft and Facebook and LinkedIn and TikTok. And I'm like, how about you be on one and focus and scale it up versus trying to be everywhere? Because when you're trying to be everywhere, you end up spreading yourself so thin that you get no momentum. For those who drive, mm-hmm. it's like having your car stuck in mud. You spin your wheels, but you don't get anywhere very fast. And that's really something hard for people to understand. And often I say, people who tell you to launch on two or three ad platforms at once are often people who are not professionals, are not pros, and have no idea what they're doing when it comes to advertising. Yes, it sounds great in theory, but in reality, if you're on three platforms at once, even if you have $20,000 a month to spend, you're not going to get anywhere because you're not going to be able to focus on what's actually working. You're just going to be trying to launch a bunch of things and see what sticks, which is not a good way to run a business.
Yeah. Focus and momentum. I'm telling you, they are the two things you need to get this cracked, isn't it? Pick the thing you're going to do and just get it moving. And then once that, if it's working, it'll generate the returns that you can use to invest in the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So, yeah, absolutely. You are one of the best thinkers about paid ads that I see on social media. And I know we've talked about this at conferences and offline before as well. So, while this is the strategy sessions, I'm not having you here and not trying to get you to go deep and geek out a little bit about the future of paid advertising. I have said some fairly critical things about PMax, Google Performance Max, but I don't use it every day. I'm only based it on some feedback from some clients who said it was terrible and awful. But when I've said that, you've been like, but here's some counterpoints. So let's firstly talk about Google. What changes have happened over the last couple of years, and what do you think's coming next, and what impacts that had on advertisers?
I mean, PMax came out, you know, 3 years ago this past October. So that's, you know, that's whether you like it or not, that's a change you just have to accept. You know, people often say I'm very pragmatic, but as a gay black man, I don't have time to cry tears about things that I can't control. I focus on the things I can control, which means one, I know Google's not going to take back PMax. So I can complain and bitch about it, or I can figure out how to use it and leverage it when it makes sense. And so when PMax works, it's the greatest thing next to sliced bread or fresh cut grass, and I love it. When it doesn't work, it's a pain in the ass and you just want to scream Google's name. But I'm glad for Google because it's given me a job for the last 17 years in an industry that I didn't know existed in high school. And so I don't hate PMax, but I don't love it either. It's just a tool I need to use when it makes sense for the business. But it's no different than smart shopping, or currently standard shopping still exists. So, you know, people often don't realize that beyond Performance Max or PMax, you can still use standard shopping to run campaigns. Google only got rid of smart shopping. So when someone says you can only use PMax, they're lying to you. You can use standard shopping as well, which is really important. And so I think at the end of the day, you know, PMax is a tool, and if it works for you, great, use it. If it doesn't work, don't use it and go to standard shopping. But beyond that, you know, Google obviously had the switch over from UA, Universal Analytics, to GA4 on July 1st. You know, that was a huge change because the way data is processed and organized in GA4 is very different than Universal Analytics or UA. And so that change was very impactful, not just for anyone in paid advertising, but anyone in advertising marketing in general. You know, we were talking with a UK brand like a couple of days ago, and they're like, we don't use GA. I don't trust it. We don't use GA4. I'm like, okay, that's fair. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the honesty. You probably want to set it up anyways, because unless you're paying for some other tool, like
you need
Fathom Analytics or something like that, you need something. Like, you just don't get it. And like, this isn't a small business. They're making a few million pounds a year. They're in an interesting space, like floor tiles and stuff like that. So it's a bit weird. But those, I'd say, are the two biggest changes. Obviously, Google, you know, this year has third-party cookies going away. People often say cookies are going away, but like first-party cookies still exist. Google's not going to try to decimate their whole business overnight. They're not idiots. You know, they make 99% of their money from advertising, you know? And so even though the last 2 or 3 years, even the last 18 months, there have been more changes in Google's books than there have been in my first 16, 17 years of doing this, I realized that the future of this industry is just more change. You know, Google, much like Amazon, much like TikTok, much like Meta, all want to, you know, automate as much as they can so they can just fire more people on their team. You know, they've got hundreds of thousands of employees and they would like to have tens of thousands of employees, but the technology isn't there yet where they can fire more people beyond what they've all fired in the last 6 months because they're trying to cut cost. And so the future is really about like guiding the machines, right? It's kind of like, you know, Will Smith and iRobot, except the robots don't have three laws to not kill you. So you've got to go in there with like, well, here's what I want to do. How can I guide the machine to do that? So PMax, you've got like search themes is a thing you can apply to campaigns. You can apply account-wide negatives for things you don't want to show for. So for example, if I sold like wooden bookcases, I might want to put the words metal and plastic as account-wide negatives because I don't sell metal, you know, bookcases. I don't sell plastic bookcases. And so really the future is about like guiding the machines in different ways, whether it's, you know, account-wide negatives, add in search themes, you know, applying different tools of technology that I'm sure Google's going to launch over the next 12 or 18 months. And then, you know, always checking in like, is Google doing what I want? Is Meta doing what I want? Is Amazon doing what I want? Is Microsoft doing what I want? And hopefully you can guide things. You know, I will say all things being equal, at times e-commerce, D2C, you know, retail brands running their campaigns online is a lot easier than if you're in like lead gen, for example. But you know, you've all picked what industry you want to work in. So now you just got to deal with it. You know, we were talking with someone on the team the other day and they were like, you know, I feel bad for the SEO agency for a client. I'm like, why would I feel bad for them? They chose to be an SEO. Their lives are getting harder. This is not my fault. I'm here to take the money and make business. And so, if you're in the industry and you're thinking about getting a switch, paid ads could always use really smart people and e-commerce is only going to get bigger. So this is a place to be versus maybe you don't want to do SEO. Maybe you don't want to do other things that are only going to get harder because Google just wants to make more money off advertising. No different than, you know, Meta. You know, Meta's at, I think, $200 billion a year. Google's at $250. I think Amazon just passed $60 billion a year in revenue. But Amazon wants to be, you know, the next Meta and the next Google. And so that means Amazon's going to do more and more automation, get more and more people on their platform to advertise. But they're all watching what Google's going to do, which is basically Google's trying to like automate everything, remove cookies as much as they can, and make our lives more difficult. But that's okay, because that's just part of the job.
So one view from a few people I've spoken to, and kind of this is my view, but pulled in from talking to people around the industry. Sure, a lot of the changes that I've seen Google make over the last couple of years, and even Facebook and Meta over the years, last 2-3 years, have some people screaming, this isn't fair, this doesn't make sense. And when you get into the detail of it, and look, you always get it, but there's a certain group of people that seem to make the same complaint over and over again. When you get into the detail of it, actually some of it is fantastic and has huge benefits to certain people. What it seems to be from the conversation that I've had is that every change that's been made on Meta and Google has been to benefit bigger advertisers. Even the move to GA4, when I looked at this, I was like, what is this platform? And when I started to get my head around it, I'm like, if I was running a site that was taking 2 million visitors a day, this is the thing I need in my life. If I run a florist down the road and cut down the street, this is absolutely useless to me because I can't, this platform does not work for me as a small business, you know, kind of a very small store. And, you know, 10 years ago, Facebook was the place that you would tell small businesses to advertise. Now you look at some of the changes and you're going, do you know what? You're probably not going to do it unless you've got big bucks to get into the game. And I wonder if that's something you'd agree with. And I also then, the second part of that question is this where Amazon have an opening? Because their advertising is still very much based around smaller products being able to get in front of customers. You know, do you see that's maybe where Amazon can scoop in and win in the next 2 to 5 years?
Yeah, those are two good questions. One, about it being unfair is complete bullshit. Let's just be honest, right? We are paying to be on the advertising platform. If you don't like the rules of the business, you don't pay the money. It's just as simple as that. If I don't like the coffee shop down the street, I don't go back and give them money. I just go to a different coffee shop. Now people argue, well, we don't have lots of options, but that's just the way the world works, right? At the end of the day, automation takes data, right? And if you're not a big enough business to get the data you need, well, then you can't use it. You know, I want to ride my bike, but I can't just put any tires on my bike. I got to put the tires that make sense, right? Like people want to complain. I get why they want to complain, but where Google was 15 years ago isn't where they are today because the industry has changed. And when I say the industry, I don't just mean like paid ads. I just mean like how marketing works, where people spend their time, right? And so, yes, it sucks, but you know the whole point of any business is you need to change your business. And that maybe means you need to merge your business with another business. Maybe you need to grow your business more. Maybe you need to just sell your business and go retire. But the reality is you're paying someone to do something. If you don't like the way they're doing it, well, stop paying the money and go somewhere else. And if you can't go somewhere else, then you need to figure out what you're going to do. I assume at some point I'm not going to have a business because at some point they're going to automate me out of business. But I accept that as risk I take in running a business. Now, if people want to use the platform, then use it. If you don't, stop bitching about it because the idea is that things should be the way they were 12 years ago is complete bollocks and doesn't make any sense. Now, in terms of people going to Amazon, I mean, yes, you could go to Amazon. I mean, Amazon, I think, is kind of like where Google was maybe 5, 6 years ago. It's a very sort of simple platform on the surface. Like obviously the back end is probably very complex, but on the surface, it's very similar to where Google was 5, 6 years ago. You know, you've got free match types. The match types are the match types they say, exact, exact, phrase is phrase, broad is broad. But, you know, the way Amazon has grown their ad business over the last 3 years from basically next to nothing to a $60 billion business, you know, in another 2 years, they'll be where Google is now probably because the rate of acceleration of change is so fast in the industry that things are changing faster than people realize. And people used to see few changes 12 years ago. Like when I lived in London in 2012, 2013, 2014, change was slower. You know, we just launched shopping campaigns. People thought they were weird. These pictures with like the image of the product and the price is like, what is this? You know, these aren't text ads. If you look at where we are now, 17 years later, it's a game changer. If there was no shopping ads, I don't know if I still have a job today because like that is like where Google makes all their money. And so the future is going to be a little bit weird. And yes, people can go to Amazon. But I think people need to look at like other platforms. Maybe they need to go to like Nextdoor. You know, Nextdoor, a lot of people spend time in Nextdoor. Maybe you need to advertise on Nextdoor. Maybe you need to look at doing things like leaflets. Maybe you need to look at like increasing your word of mouth or getting more people to give you reviews on Google. You know, people just need to change how their business is run. Too many people want to run their business today like how they ran their business 5 years ago, and you just can't do that anymore. You've got to change. It's adapt or die. And if you don't want to adapt, you're going to be out of business. I've got to change my business all the time, and it is painful. But that is what you got to do to survive. So either you're in it to win it or you're not.
Yeah. So you mentioned Nextdoor. There's a link in the show notes to an interview I did with Emma Mondolino, who is the, oh, I forget what her job title is, but she's in marketing and sales at Nextdoor. And it was a great interview. Actually, one of the best performing podcasts I've put out in that season. So there's a link in the show notes if you want to find out more about Nextdoor. Certainly a platform that is trying to get a foothold in the UK, but I think it's much bigger in North America, isn't it, in terms of the size. But the interesting thing you said about adapt or die and spending your money in different places, I am just a couple of years more vintage than you. And I started in market. People say to me, when I do other people's podcasts, one of the questions I always get asked is how did you get into digital marketing? And I often say, well, one, I'm not in digital marketing, I'm in marketing. But two, I'm old enough to have started in marketing, which became digital. And anyway, but that's the point. I started off in direct mail. That was one of my first jobs. We did, I think, more than half of our budget was direct mail, but another 30% was radio. And then the other 20% was just bits of stuff, newspapers mainly. And what really seems to me to be coming round, and what you're saying there about flyers and leaflets and different ways of doing it, is actually all the old stuff. I'm not going to say coming back, because newspaper advertising has gone. But the old way of approaching this, rather than just, we'll just throw some money at Facebook and that will do it, it'll get us customers. Having to stand back and go, okay, where are we going to plan to spend our marketing budget? How do we tackle this problem? What are we going to do about our brand? Because that's actually going to help generate more sales in the long term. And how do we reach customers? Should we be sending them letters and trying to cut through that way? I love those conversations coming. As an old school marketer who understands how all that works, I'm like, bring on the next 10 years, because this is fantastic for my business. This is great. And so do you see that coming back, those sort of old school tactics making a comeback? Is there a resurgence for old people like me? Is that, that's the question.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess you could say making a comeback. I guess it's more of a focus for people. Like, you know, the big thing I think the last few years is like, if you use a 3PL, there's like those inserts you can put in packages where it advertises other brands that are not competing. That's very powerful. That's kind of direct mail, but not 100%. You know, we've sometimes pitched ideas around like direct mail, or they're more big in Canada, but like in Canada and in America, sometimes you walk down the street and they're like, the lamppost or whatever will have like posters or flyers of businesses in the area or concerts and stuff. And so we pitched that idea to clients and like, why don't we blanket Vancouver, Canada? It's a small city at 600,000 people. You know, you blanket the whole city for 3 months over Christmas, or like October, November, December over Christmas, and see, you know, does people buy from us? You know, does it get our name out there? So we'll sometimes suggest those ideas to clients. And obviously we don't execute it. We just suggest the idea because we think it's a good idea. But I think more businesses should look at that, because like at the end of the day, if you can get more people to leave you reviews and more people know about you, in theory, you should get more business. You know, obviously it depends on what business you're in. If you're like a locksmith, you're not going to flyer the neighborhood because you only need a locksmith when you need to be locked out. So maybe getting more reviews on Google would make more sense, and running ads would make more sense. But if you're like a bakery, or there's like a plant store that opened up last summer around the corner, they blanketed the neighborhood in every flyer pool. That's how I bought my latest cactus plant. So this stuff does work. It just obviously depends on like what business, what you sell. Is it business people need to know about? And then do the, you know, old school tack, but that does work. And people do read poster signs and stuff like that. And it could be a good way to get your name out there if you're like a more localized business. Even if you were a big business and like you were in London and you're across London, I mean, you could blanket all of London. You could buy some like outdoor out-of-home ads. You know, back in 2017, 2018, I want to say more businesses were doing like out-of-home ads. Like in America, a lot of people in like New York and LA were buying like lots of subway space. And especially if you're like a D2C brand, you had raised VC money, you'd buy like the New York subway and just plaster your ad everywhere. So that stuff is very trendy when you've got VC money to burn. But I think it's trendy now with people who maybe don't have VC money to burn, but they've got a target audience they want to like advertise to.
It's felt a little bit like 2007 in my business recently. The client I've been working with a lot over the last couple of months, when you look at the budget split, it has been probably 50% on radio, 25% on outdoor, and 25% on Meta. Now, it's a very particular target market in a very particular set of areas, quite low income customers as well for numerous reasons. But it's actually, you know, some of the old school tactics have just, when we've done the research, have just come through time and time again. And I have been loving it, Dwayne. I mean, I was like, I haven't done a radio campaign. I haven't been involved in a radio campaign forever. This has been amazing. It's been great. I used to do like a dozen radio campaigns a year in 2005. And now I was like, I haven't done one for like 10 years. So it's been fantastic to be involved in.
Yeah, I think it does work. Like back when I started the agency, our first client was a fintech brand in Canada. And so we bought transit ads. They bought like newspaper. They did in-person events. They did radio, because they were going after, at the start, we were going after everyone in Canada. And then we switched to going after people basically 40, 50 plus who were about to retire or retired, so we can manage their money through our fintech brand. And that was kind of our target market. So going after newspapers, mm-hmm. radio, transit made a lot of sense. And then I still handle just, you know, obviously, you know, the Google, Meta, and Microsoft, and they handled all the like outdoor traditional Buffett line stuff. But yeah, I mean, if your target audience is an audience that listens to the radio, it's good. You know, back in the day, this is maybe 2012, you know, I bought podcast ads, which were very like new back then, and that did really well. But obviously there was only a handful of podcasts out there and only a handful of podcasts around tech. So this stuff I think does work. It just depends on like who your target audience is and do they, you know, watch or listen to the radio, or do they like watch videos and things in the subway or watch the ads in the subway? But it's a very cost-effective way to advertise if you want to like make a splash.
Yeah, definitely. Podcasting ads back in the day, hey, that would have been great to do. Anyway, let's move on. Let's move on from talking about the good old days, because I could quite easily just sit and reminisce forever. We met in person at conferences. That's where we met, and you speak at a number of conferences, and so do I. So you've done, I don't know, dozens and dozens of conferences over the years.
Yeah.
What's the secret, I suppose? People often ask me, how do you get so many speaking gigs and what do you do? I never really know how to answer that question. I mean, I've got some thoughts, but what's the secret? You know, what, A, why did you start doing it? And B, how did you manage to keep picking up more and more and more?
Yeah, I think those are two questions. I actually don't think there's a secret per se. I think for most conferences, you just need a pitch. Mm-hmm. You know, the rule I always say, if a conference says you can pitch up to three ideas, then you should pitch two or three ideas. Because if you only pitch one idea, there's a good chance they're not going to take your idea because someone else already pitched it, or it doesn't make sense for the conference theme. So a lot of conferences I just get pitched. I think it's rare that I get asked to speak anywhere. There's a couple conferences like Brighton SEO, they'll ask me to speak because I've spoken mm-hmm. so much and they know I'll say yes and I help promote it and stuff like that. But most conferences, I just filled out a form and gave up my ideas. Like the other day, I pitched a couple conferences in Spain because we have a team member in Spain. And I'm like, oh, this would be a great way to see the teammate. Go to Spain, because who doesn't love Spain? Meet some people, maybe in the local Spanish market potentially, because there's lots of e-commerce in sort of Spain and Portugal. And then, you know, I think if people want to get picked up at more and more conferences, I think it's just pitching good ideas, but pitching like good ideas that maybe other people also don't talk about. You know, at lots of conferences, I talk about shopping feeds and Google shopping campaigns. And I also talk about things that people don't think are true. Like I think ad creative in your PMax campaign is really important. I think having an amazing shopping feed is really important. I've been saying about shopping feeds the last 6 years that people probably think I'm sick of me talking about it. But day in and day out, we've got clients. Sometimes the only change we make on a client's account is just build a better shopping feed. Yes, we've changed some campaigns and changed some bid strategies, and that all matters. Don't get me wrong. But if we did all of that but didn't change the feed, it wouldn't matter one bit. And so I think people just need to pick their thing they want to talk about at every conference and have it be their thing. So my thing is, you know, Shopify, CRO, Google shopping campaign, shopping feeds. And that's all I talk about. Mm-hmm. I talk about it, those three things. I just talk about it over and over and over and what we're thinking, what we're seeing. I think the thing I'll start pitching, not this year, but maybe next year, is like B2B e-com. We're picking up more and more B2B e-com. And I think talking about that could be super interesting because you often don't see as many B2B e-com people there, but it could be a good way to like niche out even more at conferences. So you just got to pitch if you want to speak at a conference, pitch two or three ideas that you want to talk about. The more fleshed out and detailed you can be with those ideas, that's helpful. And then you won't get, you know, every conference. So lots of conferences I pitch I don't get into because they already have tons of people for that topic. They don't want to mm-hmm. have that session. And so, you know, my goal these days is get into two or three conferences and that's it, because A, it's expensive to fly places. Not every conference is going to pay you. I don't want to spend more time with our team and our clients and not spend, you know, so much time on the road.
Yeah. So how do you construct a story for your presentations? And what I mean by that is you talk about very different things to me. So I talk about marketing strategy almost everywhere, sometimes a bit about how you craft communications, but mostly almost always marketing strategy, which allows me to tell stories, look at big concepts, and kind of use a lot of examples of clients and companies do it well, companies do it badly, that type of thing. When you're talking about like shopping feeds, people want you to get into the weeds, don't they? They want to get into the detail, like how do you do it? And there's a whole raft of presentations I see at conferences of people who do detail on things like that, technical detail. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do it. I just not, you know, if you give me all the time, like, go and present that, I wouldn't know where to start because I couldn't build a story around it that would keep people engaged throughout the whole presentation. So what's your creative process when it comes to that? And you go, right, okay, I've got to talk about this technical thing. How am I going to do it? What's your creative process?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I've got a creative process per se, and I definitely don't tell a story. I also don't tell jokes. I realize that the jokes I think are funny on stage, people don't think are funny.
There is nothing better than telling a joke, is there, on stage? And when you stop and you're like, nobody's laughing. Okay, just move on. Just move on.
I've had that happen. That's why I don't tell jokes anymore. I mean, at Brighton SEO once, I said something and everyone laughed. I'm like, well, that wasn't a joke, but I'm going to move on now because you all were finding that very funny. So I don't tell jokes. But I mean, basically, like, I think for me, it starts with my pitch. My pitch is like, here's my opening line and problem. Here are the four or five things I'm going to talk about in my talk. And here's my closing line, why I think it's really important. And then I craft my pitch around that. You know, line one is things you need to know or things that are important or why the market is changing. Here's how you need to do what you do. Maybe there's like a setup section, like here's how you set it up. So shopping feeds, you've got like do it yourself with a Google Sheet. You've got technology. You've got apps you can use. Okay, we talked about how you can set it up. Well, here's the things you want to do when you build your sheet. So here's some examples. Sometimes we use clients. Sometimes we use like big brands like Nike, so it's easy for people to understand. We go through some examples, and then I kind of do, at the end, I do a summary. Here's the things I want you to take away. And then sometimes my summary is where people tend to ask me questions, like Brighton SEO in April last year, I made a comment how you should refresh your creative on your PMax campaign more often than we would have in the past when you think about like how often you used to refresh search ads. And I had no less than four people come up to me after the talk and ask about that one comment I made as an off-cuff remark because I needed an extra slide in my deck to get to 20 minutes. And so I don't necessarily tell a story as much as I stick to the facts. Here's what I think, here's how we do it, here's what you should do, and here's why you should do it. And then some people like it, some people don't. I mean, most people like it, but you know, if you don't, you don't, you do. But I don't really care either way. I'm just telling you what I think, and that's just the way it is.
Unhooking yourself from bothering, when you realize that you can't make everybody happy, that's actually a really nice place to get to, isn't it? It's like some people aren't going to like what I've got to say, and that's perfectly fine. And that's a great place to get to. But I like where you started there. You had this, you said about the what's the problem you're trying to solve. And you say you don't have a creative process, but if you start very much with a clear statement of intent, that is, here's the problem I want to solve in this, and I'm going to tell you how we do it in this presentation. That is a creative process, isn't it? You start with a problem and you take people through a solution. Isn't that
That's fair. Yeah, I think because that's the way I always pitch my conference. I don't think of it as like a creative process. It's just my like opening paragraph, five bullet points, closing paragraph, pitch it and see if they like it or not. You know? Yeah.
And see what
I guess
they
the other tip
there.
I'd say for people pitching conferences, I'd also pitch the same thing at every conference. That way you can reuse your deck throughout the year. Trying to make a custom deck for every conference is just the worst. I know conferences want that, but unless you're pitching like, you don't pitch, but unless you got to speak at like MozCon where they ask you to speak, you shouldn't be making a custom deck for every conference, right? If they're not paying you to be at the conference, you shouldn't be making them a custom deck. Like that's just nonsense.
So Will Reynolds from Sia Interactive was talking on social media not long ago about this, about how he sees it as like it keeps his creative juices flowing, doing something different at every conference he goes to. And I think I went in the comments, I was like, are you mad? Every year I come up with a new presentation and then I will hawk that around for the year. And, you know, I've got kind of three or four that I'm really happy with from over the years. Some of them were just like, they didn't work for whatever reason. So now I've got a little bit of a back catalog too. And people are like, what would you talk about? I'm like, I've got these three, pick one. And I know they work. I know how they work. There is a little bit of refining for the audience. So next week, although it'll be in the past by the time anyone hears this, but next week I'm speaking at Disney World for a conference about higher education. So some of the examples in that presentation, the same one I used at Moz, but some of the examples have changed because it's not an SEO audience, it's a higher education audience. So there's a bit of a tweak to it. It's only about 10-15% that's changed. Everything else is staying the same.
It does make life easier. Yeah. I mean, I've got two presentations that I will be my go-to presentation at a conference. I've done it lots of times. I know it very well. The deck gets updated throughout the year as Google makes changes to shopping feeds and Google campaigns, but the structure is basically the same, you know, how to make a better shopping feed. And then I update it based on our internal processes as a team. It just makes life a lot easier. And Will speaks at tons of conferences a year. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if he told us he spoke at 35 conferences a year, right? Mm-hmm. And so he probably has a really good process to make a new deck for each conference. I don't know what that process is, but I imagine he's got a really good process to do that. You know, I also imagine he probably has a team to maybe potentially help him. Like maybe there's a designer that helps him with some stuff. I imagine he doesn't do everything on his own. Whereas I do everything on my own. So I don't really have a designer potentially to help me or someone else who might help me on the team. Because, you know, Will's got a bigger agency than us, right? He's got 200 people. Yeah. You know, I'm sure he's got a designer that helps him with something like that. You know, but he's got a process to do that. And I respect him for being on a plane that much. Even if it's just like flying there and flying back on the same day, it's still flying around. A lot of cities and countries, given a lot of presentations. So I respect whatever his process is to make that happen, because I'm exhausted just thinking about it.
Yeah, people say to you, oh, it must be great doing all this, that. And I am not asking for sympathy, right? But nobody likes that 3:30 a.m. alarm call. Nobody likes the jet lag when you fly from the UK to the West Coast and you're like, oh, your body, you're waking up at 2 a.m. or you're falling asleep at 3 p.m. Nobody likes that, right? But listen, I chose this life. Nobody forced me into it. I enjoy it. So, I'm not complaining.
Yeah. I tell friends, it's always not glamorous. Sometimes you're working in a hotel room and, you know, you're getting work done and eating whatever takeout you got from whatever restaurant. It's not all, you know, being exactly, on the beach when you're done the speaking gig and stuff. But I'd rather this than working for someone else.
Definitely. Definitely. But I do have one complaint about the speaking world. And this is, to be honest, Wayne, it's entirely your fault. So you're gonna have to take the blame for this, because you are in Toronto. Therefore, this must make it your fault. Why aren't there any good or any digital marketing events? Why is there no big conference in Toronto? It's a huge city. It's an amazing city. It's a fantastic city. Where's the marketing event? I've got family there. I want an invite to come and speak at the conference. Why hasn't it happened? This is your fault, Dwayne. What are you gonna do about it?
You know, a few years ago, like in 2011, 2012, I ran a conference for a couple of years. It's called Eat Strategy. It is a strategy conference. And I put it on myself and I paid for it myself, and it was really expensive. I think there's a couple of things at play. I think it's one, like we're a big landmass like America, but unlike America, we only have 40 million people. So convincing enough people to come to the conference is not really that easy. You can kind of convince people in America, but then you've got to have the budget to like spend on ads to let people know there's a conference. When Americans have so many conferences south of the border they go to, why spend more money crossing the border, going through customs just to come to Canada? There are a couple like social media type conferences in like Calgary and in Vancouver on the West Coast. But I think it's just because it's expensive to put on a conference in Toronto. It is not cheap. The conference halls are real expensive. The place I found to put on the conference was cheap, and it was in one of the museums here. But it's hard to put on a conference here because I think it's just the cost if you do one of the traditional venues. And then you got to get speakers, and then all your speakers are all going to be Canadian. If they're all going to be Canadian, it might be harder to convince people to come to the conference because they want to hear, you know, bigger name people, i.e. Americans, or even some people over in Europe. I flew half the people from America to Canada to do the conference, right? So it's hard, I think, just from the logistics of like getting speakers who are going to get people to come. Like I had Mark Pohl come from like New York. He's really popular. He's really popular on Twitter. That got a lot of people to come to the conference because it's like, oh, it's Mark. I have to come because this was 2011 when he was starting to blow up. So I think it's hard to do it from like, yes, we're in North America, but we're not America. So convincing people and speakers to come is harder than people think. And then we don't have enough people really within Toronto to fill a conference. And it's so expensive that you have to sell tickets prices at a high rate. I mean, I'd love to put on a conference in theory, but in reality, it would just be a full-time job and a nightmare.
Yeah. Do you know what that sounds like, Dwayne? It sounds like you're making excuses, is what it sounds like. And what I really want is I just want an invite. I mean, I'll do it for a sec, you know, a couple of $1,000 and flights. I won't even need a hotel. I'll stay with the family, right? But just... Look, it sounds like you're making excuses. 2024, make it the year of flying me over to Toronto to speak at a conference. That's really what we're looking for here. It's what the audience want. It's what the listeners want. Everyone's screaming at the handset going, Dwayne, just put the conference on or find somebody to do it. I think that's what's happening, really. Don't you think?
Yeah. You know, you're not the first person to ask that question. It gets asked all the time. about why we don't have like a bigger conference. You know, you see tons of stuff in New York as the closest example. You know, you got Inbound obviously in Boston, which is also, you know, put on by HubSpot. You think there would be more. You know, you got tons of conferences off in Chicago as well, which is so underrated as a city for conferences, but not a lot in Toronto. Yeah, and it's probably never going to change.
Are you almost too close to other cities? You know, when I went to Philadelphia for Search Love, I flew to Toronto to see my family afterwards. And I met a couple of attendees from Toronto there, and they were like, yeah, but it's easy. You know, it's only an hour and a half flight or whatever to get there. And are you just almost too close to all those great northeastern cities in the US? Whereas if you're in Calgary, I mean, you've got to fly a long way from Calgary to go and find something good to happen, haven't you? So maybe that's it. Maybe it's geography. Okay.
Yeah, I'll
let you off. You know, when you become mayor of Toronto, which will be your next job, I'm assuming, and you can't be worse than some of the previous mayors we've had. But when you become mayor of Toronto, maybe we can make this happen. Well,
maybe. I mean, our current new mayor, Olivia Chow, is amazing. I'm glad she won mayorship. Our past two mayors are mediocre white men who should have been fired long ago from their job, but weren't, unfortunately. But our current mayor, Olivia Chow, amazing. We love her. If you want someone who's going to invest in the city and invest in the people.
Fantastic. Now, I'm not going to say anything libelous that's going to get me into trouble, but if you don't know anything about the mayors of Toronto, you know, the words mafia might come to mind. Just Google kind of mayors of Toronto. There's a family business going on there and some great slash hilarious stories, as long as you don't live in Toronto and pay taxes there and want stuff doing. But it is, it's quite, there's some interesting stories. Anyway, moving on quickly. Look, we've got time for one more question to ask you, Dwayne. And that's really simple, yet also really difficult. Give us a book recommendation for people who are listening. What would you suggest they read to become better at some form of marketing or just anything, really?
This is going to sound really weird, and I'm actually not going to give a book recommendation. What I'm going to recommend people is just read in general, but read things that actually aren't related to marketing or business. Yes. My best ideas often come to be when I'm not doing work. So like we have a great public library system here in Toronto. So I tend to read a lot of like mystery thriller type books. Sometimes I read a biography book. So I say just read in general. There's a book I read a year ago called The Luxury Strategy book, I want to say. And it was basically all about like how to price things to make them more expensive, basically. And it talked about like difference between something that is expensive and something that's luxury. So like Apple would be expensive, but Apple isn't luxury. And it talked about like some of those old world brands like Gucci and stuff from Europe and how they're luxury, but not expensive. And it was interesting to read. It's very academic. So if you're not into reading things that are very academic, I would say don't read it. And I'm definitely getting the title wrong, but it definitely has the words "the luxury and strategy" in there.
It is. It's by Bernard. I've just Googled it. Let's have a look. So there's an author, but there's also a sub-author of it. Because luxury works in a really weird way, because in most industries, you would basically increase demand to meet supply. But in luxury, you do the opposite. You throttle demand to keep prices high. By Jean-Noël Capfer and Van Bastien, Vincent Bastien. There you go. Apologies for my pronunciation. The Luxury Strategy. It is in the show notes, as is a link to another podcast I did with a girl from Dublin who works for one of the big luxury houses and now has launched her own podcast, Tech Powered Luxury, Ashley McDonald. Tech Powered Luxury is fantastic, and her podcast from the very first series, actually, she recommended that book. So I'll put all of that in the show notes too. But yeah, great book. So brilliant.
Yeah, well, look, Dwayne, I was just going to say someone recommended it on Twitter, and it was on my list for a year, and then I read it when I was on vacation in the Dominican a year ago. And it had me think about just like how we price things, and I just raised our fees and said, this is what it is. So if you think about trying to like raise your fees, become more expensive, thinking about your position as a business, I think it's worthy you read to think about it, because I want to be Gucci or Prada and charge more money. I just have people realize that like you can buy cheaper models of things, but if you want the best, you're going to pay more money for better quality. It's definitely a harder thing to do, but it's definitely a good book to read. And I read it end to end. I was glad I read it end to end. You just have to get past the first two chapters, I would say, are really tough. But after that, it's a pretty good read.
Cool. Excellent. No, I sent a copy of that to a client once who was in that sort of end of the world, and he loved it. He, you know, he was raving about it. So yeah, okay. I might even read it one day. Dwayne, we've got a time difference. It's getting dark and cold here. It's lunchtime for you, so I'm going to let you go and grab your lunch. And thank you very much for your time. How do people find you? What's the best platform to get you on?
Yeah, so I spend, you know, a fair bit of time on LinkedIn. So just Dwayne Brown is my like username, quote unquote, on LinkedIn. Also, just takesomerisk.com, so agency website. You can always send us an email if you want to chat about a problem or an issue you're having. And then I spend a lot of time on Reddit, but if you don't know my handle on Reddit, you would know who I am. But I'm Fathom53 on Reddit, so that's kind of where I spend most of my time, is Reddit, LinkedIn. And then otherwise, I'm trying to like not think about work, and I like read books, I go for walks, I ride my bike a lot, I cook a fair bit. Because like I said, when I recommended the book, most of my best ideas happen when I'm not actually at my desk or at work.
Yeah, amazing that that's the case, isn't it? When you stop thinking about it, that's when they come to you. So, brilliant. Well, look, Dwayne, thank you for your time. It's been a brilliant time chatting with you, and we shall see you soon at another conference somewhere.
Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it.